Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Wake up to something different on Sunday mornings by joining me, Pete Evans, for Spinning Jazz. The finest in modern jazz, from hard bop to bossa nova, from Latin to soul. That's Spinning Jazz every Sunday morning at 9 on Sheffield Live. 93.2 FM.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk, and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. You've got Julian Paul here live in the studio as usual. Unfortunately, our guest speaker for every third Saturday of the month, which is Gareth Morgan, can't be with us this Saturday. He's the ex-president of Sheffield Photographic Society. He's still a member of that society as well. They do some great stuff. There will be some exhibitions coming up soon, so more about that in the coming months. All being well, next Saturday, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Chris Dale. Mm-hmm. And later in this hour, as always, we'll be speaking to our PG. First up, though...
Yes, Elsica's Great Engine is back in action on Sunday, the 26th of October at 12 noon and 2 p.m. The new Coleman Beam Engine at Elsica is the oldest steam engine still in its original location in the world. Invented by Thomas Newcomen to pump water from the coal mines, it was the first ever practical engine. Learn more about this fascinating invention, its story at Elsica, and how it would have worked. The tour lasts 1 hour and costs £6 per person. So if you go online and go to Elsica Heritage Centre at barnsley.gov.uk, you'll find all the details.
I have a feeling that might be very booked up very quickly. Yeah, yeah. So yes. That's next Sunday, the 26th of October, 12 noon and 2 p.m. And of course, the clocks will have gone back by then. So
it's dark this morning.
I can't believe It indeed it is, or was. Right, next up, a great, great story. I did allude to this the other week that I was going to talk about this. It's an article, an interview with Raymond Blanc. It's called Our Earth is Our Gold. It's an extract from the October 2025 Royal Horticultural Society magazine, and I thought it was rather interesting. He says, connection with the earth and good food are the pillars of my life. So if for people who don't know, he is I think he's head chef patron of Le Manoir Quatre Saisons in Oxford, but I think he's stepping down. He's not a young man anymore, but he's very famous, held 2 Michelin stars for a long time. So when he first came to that building, he transformed the place, and in particular the garden. It was important to him. So this article's all about that. So the first question they asked him was, how do you trial vegetables at Le Manoir? And he said, trials are the foundation on which the best vegetables are chosen. If you have a bad cultivar growing in good soil, you still have a bad cultivar, but growing a great one in average soil will still be good. So for me, the cultivar is even more important than good soil. When I grow a potato, for example, I want the right selection for the right purpose. So Maris Piper, for French fries or chips, he says, Charlotte for salad and usually Duke of York for anything he sautés. It's the same for tomatoes, as they all have different acidity. For puree, it's Roma and San Marzano and Cœur de Bleu, also known as Cœur de Bœuf. Is great stuff. Oh, Cœur de Bleu or Cœur de Bœuf is great for stuffing. And he says, when we do trial tasting, it can be 15, 20 or more different cultivars at once. We give marks for taste, texture, flavour and colour. But the key concern is whether it has soul. I remember doing a tasting of 40 chili peppers, but that wasn't a good idea. Everyone was crying by the end. At least we found that the best one was Padron. So there you go. And they asked him, do you favour new or old cultivars? And he says, many old ones are very beautiful but don't always taste great. Every British person will hate me, but the worst apple in the UK is Bramley's Seedling from an old tree. It blows your head off and completely removes your taste buds. It's high acid and water content means that when exposed to heat, it explodes and you can mash it up in 2 seconds. But you have to have at least a third of the weight of sugar. That's not gastronomy for me. Added sugar is the enemy of good health and taste. I think that's very important.
Well said.
Added sugar, and this is one of the top chefs in the world, added sugar is the enemy of good health and taste. But thanks to recent breeding, he says, I love modern Bramleys because they've changed completely. They still have high acidity, but balanced with much more sweetness. So they asked him, are you particularly fond of apples? He said, my mum grew apple trees in the garden, especially Renette du Canada. And today we grow, listen to this, 153 different apples at Le Manoir Quatre Saisons in Oxford. When I first came to England, people just simply talked about eating apples or cooking apples. Why not talk of apples for purees, for tart tatin or for pan frying? There are thousands of cultivars and they all have their own qualities. I've discovered the best apple. He's in shock here. He says the best apple is not French, but English. He says Cox's Orange Pippin is beautiful and I never had so many aromatics in an apple. However, it's not very disease resistant. An alternative would be the modern cultivar Red Windsor, a perfect all-rounder. Adams Pearman is a classic Devonshire Quarrenden, and Queen Cox are both excellent. And they have such beautiful names as well, he says. And very interestingly, the final question, or one of the final questions, they asked him, any breeders or veg growers that you find inspiring? And he said the East Malling Research Centre in Kent is one of the biggest centres of fruit science. He says it's extraordinary. Their breeding is all about taste. They have 700 cultivars of strawberry, for example. Some yellow, can't say I've seen those, some maroon, some acidic, and some with all the aromas of wild woodland strawberries. They bred my favourite marshmallow Also inspiring is Anne Claude Lethlave, one of the great winemakers in Burgundy, who said, "Our earth is our gold." She meant, if you don't have good soil, you'll never be able to grow the best vegetables or grapes. And he says, I keep that sentence close to my heart. Cracking track there. It's a shame to stop it. We've played it before. In That Quiet Earth by Genesis. Wind and Wuthering was the album, just in case you're wondering. Belter. We played that because we're talking about Raymond Blanc from Le Manoir. Cat Stizans, well, he still is there at the moment. I think he's stepping down as of the end of this year. Our Earth is Our Gold. And in particular, I've learnt something I didn't know, that the East Malling Research Station in Kent is one of the biggest centres of fruit science. Who knew? Of course, listen to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're every Saturday morning talking about science in all its different forms from 11 till 12. We normally have guest speakers every week, but unfortunately Gareth can't be with us this week. But all being well, Chris will be with us next
what's
week.
What's Gareth? He's gone to see American football.
I think he's gone to see some football. How exciting.
American football, yes.
Yeah. So next up is a story I saw in the press a few weeks ago. It said, ironclad evidence shows how Bronze Age ended. It says, evidence of Bronze Age smiths experimenting with iron for the first time has been uncovered. Bronze tools and weapons were generally of superior quality to those made of iron, leading to questions over why it came to replace bronze as the metal of choice, and why humanity moved from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age about 3,000 years ago. Yes, it's that long ago. Well, this is a question if ever you heard one. Bronze is made of copper and tin. But the latter, which is tin, was hard to come by, making it difficult and expensive to mass produce bronze weapons and tools. Once smiths learned how to smelt iron ore to extract the iron, it was cheaper and more abundant metal. This helped to fuel the expansion of agriculture and warfare as it became easier to equip large armies with weapons. Iron was used as a metal before the Iron Age, but this mostly came from naturally occurring iron found in meteorites, can you believe, making it extremely rare and more valuable than gold. Scientists have been trying to pinpoint how, when and where early workshops started experimenting with the extraction of iron and have analysed metal found at a 3,000-year-old smelting site in southern Georgia called, and I will do my best, Kiemobolnissey. And when it was first analysed in the 1950s, scientists found piles of hematites, an iron oxide mineral, and also slag, a waste product, and they thought they had found an early iron workshop. Analysis has now found that the workshop was actually a site for smelting copper, a key ingredient in bronze, and the iron oxide was being added into the furnace to help extract more copper. And that's according to a study in the Journal of Archaeological Science. It shows that these ancient copper metal workers were starting to experiment with iron-bearing materials in a metallurgical furnace, which was a crucial step towards iron smelting. And that's according to researchers from Cranfield University in Bedford. Now, Nathaniel Herb Satulo of Cranfield said, "Iron is the world's quintessential industrial metal, but the lack of written records, iron's tendency to rust, and a lack of research on iron production sites has made the search for its origins challenging. That's what makes this site at Kiemobolnissey in Georgia so exciting. It's evidence of intentional use of iron in the copper smelting process." Another a great track. We did want to really turn it off. We have played that on Glory Days Rock Show, of course. That is Black Sabbath with Iron Man off one of my favourite albums of theirs, Paranoid, from 1970. And what a sound they had. And we talked about, played that because we were talking about evidence of bronze Bronze Age Smiths experimented with iron for the first time has been uncovered. All interesting stuff. You're listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, of course. Next up, elsewhere in the science news this week, all sorts of interesting stories. Here we go.
Yeah, firstly, Parkinson's disease has long been a study in frustration. The tremors that affect patients stem from a shortage of dopamine, a chemical messenger in the brain. Drugs can top up supplies and bring temporary relief, but they do nothing to repair the faulty circuits that cause a loss in the first place. A new approach is now gaining attention, the replacement of the damaged dopamine circuits with living implants. The first prototypes have been created from lab-grown brain cells, which have been modified so they can be controlled electronically. Wow.
Oh, I know.
Try and get your ride in that one. Britain has quietly become one of the most ambitious backers of this kind of biohybrid technology. The Advanced Research and Invention Agency, ARIA, A-R-I-A, a government body set up to fund science on the edge of the possible, is bankrolling what may be the most audacious effort yet to make the idea a reality.
Yeah, Parkinson's disease is a very difficult one tackle. Very interesting. Meanwhile, a blood test to detect 50 types of cancer correctly finds the disease in nearly half of cases, researchers have said. Scientists are hopeful that the simple test could one day be given once a year to everyone over 50 as a form of mass screening for many cancers. Called Galleri and made by Grail, an American pharmaceutical firm, it looks for tiny fragments of tumour DNA in the blood to spot cancer early before symptoms begin.
Yeah, that story is everywhere. It's one of the top stories at the moment.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Elsewhere in the news, renewable sources of energy overtook coal as the leading source of electricity around the world in the first half of 2025. According to the energy think tank Ember, global electricity demand actually rose by 2.6% in the first half of 2025, with this growth easily met by solar and wind power, which analysts described as a sign of a crucial turning point.
And you think that's good news, don't you, Bert? It was also reported this week that, according to a scientific study that involved a total of 160 authors from 23 countries and 87 institutions, the world has officially reached its catastrophic tipping point linked to climate change. A tipping point is a critical threshold which, if passed, can cause extreme and irreversible climatic changes. This first threshold relates to coral reefs, which are now in uncharted territory, quote, due to rising ocean temperatures causing mass bleaching events. The report concluded that unless we return to global mean surface temperatures of 1.2 degrees Celsius, and ideally to at least 1 degree Celsius as fast as possible, we will not retain warm water reefs on our planet at any meaningful scale.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a new global survey also shows that more than half of all bird species are in decline, driven mainly by deforestation. While 1 in 10 European wild beast species are at risk of extinction, new assessments also indicate that 65 species of European butterflies face extinction risk, up from 37 in 2010. These findings were published ahead of this year's meeting of the International Union for Conservation of Nature to discuss their red list, which assesses global biodiversity.
And finally, Greenwich's Royal Observatory is improving access to its buildings and creating new educational and event spaces in a £77 million project due to be completed by spring 2028. A lift tower will be built to the Great Equatorial Telescope, which is currently only accessible via a small spiral staircase. The Great Equatorial Telescope, which is a centrepiece of the project, is the 10th largest telescope of its kind ever built, and is housed in the observatory's Onion Dome. Four new interactive astronomy galleries, a covered courtyard named Astronomer's Court to house live science events, and a roof terrace to live stream celestial events will be built. I bet Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society are watching that with interest. They've got their observatory up near Hoover Stand, of course. And down in Greenwich, a new entrance pavilion is also being created to better direct people from Greenwich Park into the Royal Observatory, which is part of a UNESCO UNESCO World Heritage Site. Another track we didn't want to turn off, Astronomy Domine from Pink Floyd, Papa at the Gates of Dawn, 1967. Mad. Oh, a very interesting track. We played that because we're talking about the Great Equatorial Telescope, which is the centrepiece of the project to improve access to the Greenwich Royal Observatory, £77 million project due to be completed by spring 2028. You're listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Before we speak to RPG, we've got another little story which made me smile, and I'm sure RPG will like it as well. Deciding when to turn your heating on is a hotly debated topic in Britain. Experts broadly agree that the ideal temperature is ideal time is when temperatures consistently drop, often aligning with the clocks going back, which is actually next weekend, the 26th yes. of October in this case. The experts recommend thinking about heating the rooms where you spend most of your time and not your whole home. You could also explore some efficient alternatives that can be cosy and budget-friendly. One cost-effective option is to use electric heaters. For example, a standard electric heater typically uses 2,000 watts, costing about 50 pence an hour to run. By contrast, a gas boiler and radiator system costs about £1.45 an hour.
Wow.
This shows that being smart about your heating choices can lead to significant savings during the colder months. When you set your thermostat, you may typically keep it at 22 degrees Celsius or higher during the chilliest months. However, the Energy Saving Trust suggests that 18 degrees Celsius to 21 degrees Celsius, somewhere in that range, is cozy enough in winter for most people. And by simply reducing your thermostat from 22 degrees Celsius to 21 degrees Celsius, you could save about £90 a year. But there is a caveat, as always, for households with vulnerable individuals, it's sensible to maintain a warmer temperature, which is about 23 degrees Celsius. But importantly, babies' bedrooms should be in the range 16 degrees Celsius to 20 degrees Celsius, and that's according to the NHS advice. Yeah. Most radiators feature adjustable thermostatic valve controls, which allow you to customize the temperature in each room. It's a good idea to set the radiator lower in rooms that aren't in use, helping to keep adjacent rooms warmer and prevent mold in less used spaces. A good starting point is to set the radiator valves to a number 3 or 4 on the usual scale of 1 to 5. So find the midpoint of that, allowing you to find that sweet spot for comfort. When it comes to heating strategies, if you have a boiler heating your home on demand, heating your home on demand can be more efficient than leaving it on continuously. Alternatively, if you're using a heat pump, maintaining a consistent wall throughout the day can actually help you save on bills. Additionally, using timers to turn on your heating just before you wake up and off when you go to bed can help you manage your energy use effectively. If you're away during the day, programming your system to turn off in your absence and back on shortly before you return can maximize efficiency. I think that's some cracking advice. Right there with the heat is on. We played that because we're talking about that tricky question often debated in many households in England and across the UK, in fact. deciding when to turn your heating on. There's some great advice out there. Check out the Energy Saving Trust and the NHS for some more advice. Brilliant stuff. Listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're sounding well. It was a bit of a dark morning this morning, I have to say, though.
Yeah, well, it's still a bit of a grey day, but apparently we're going to hold off the rain until somewhat later in the day.
Yeah, we need a bit of rain, don't we? So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
A few things. I think the blood test that America's been trialling for identifying cancers.
Yes.
I think it's 51 types of cancer it can pick up on. And what they're saying is at the moment it's just over 60% accurate. And as one expert was saying, well, that's not much better than flipping a coin.
Oh.
It's a 50-50 option, isn't it? So what they're saying is that it needs refining, and the NHS is going to play a part in that because they're going to run a trial for the next 18 months to see how they go on with it. So the promise is that you've got an easy early diagnostic, and if they can refine it down and improve its accuracy, then it can make a great contribution towards dealing with cancer cases. But one of the fears is that it's quite a broad spread. So what they want to prevent is over-treatment of cancers that may be dormant or not going to develop. So that's going to be part of the basis of the trial. But good news, and it's sort of picking up on things. And I guess on the local front, one of the things that I noticed, I got the word Polaris. And I don't know if you're part of that generation, but I am. Certainly, that's the undersea carried missile system that is supposed to be our nuclear defence. So I was quite surprised, actually, to have a look beneath the bonnet, as they say, and something to do with the University of Sheffield. And basically, they just won an award, and it's been awarded to Professor Jim Wild, who's the University of Sheffield representative for the prize, which is the Institute of Physics Peter Mansfield Prize. And that's for his contributions to lung imaging with hyperpolarized gas MRI. So that's magnetic resonance imaging. And it's developing the accuracy on that to enable better diagnosis and monitoring of lung diseases. So it's going to help clinicians to detect even conditions such as asthma, COPD, cystic fibrosis, and measure lung function more precisely and non-invasively to track how their treatments are going on. So I think he's been at the University of Sheffield since the early 2000s, and I say this is recognition of his work. So he is a leader of the Polaris And so, great reveal. Pulmonary, lung and respiratory imaging Sheffield.
I thought, where's Paul going with this? Hang on, he started talking about Polaris and nuclear defence, looking under the bonnet, and then hang on, he's on about lung and imaging for an MRI. I get it now then. Go on good then, say that again then. Pulmonary,
lung and respiratory imaging Sheffield research group.
Ooh! I like
an acronym
it.
Polaris, which, I didn't want to confuse people with it, but it's an interesting one. Great work that's been done, and it includes the spin exchange hyperpiper polarization RF coil design and magnetic resonance imaging development. And that's for helping to interpret a wide range of lung diseases. So great that we've got diagnostics that are sort of improving on things. And he says he's very grateful and honoured to have received the reward as a part of the physics community in recognition of the group's work in Sheffield.
Wow.
So some great work going on again.
Amazing.
I think, what else did I have a look at?
Well, we were talking about the other week about the University of Sheffield going up the ranks in best universities from the Sunday Times. They're up an extra place. I think they're number 13, and they're so well regarded for the research quality.
Yeah, and amazing. I think from my point of view, a nod towards their media representatives who do a very good job of keeping us informed on things. So.
Yeah, because often they don't blow their own trumpet, really. They're too busy getting on and doing the work, aren't they, the research?
Yeah, well, sometimes it's a bit cloistered academia. It's great within the academic world. But sometimes us poor people outside don't get to know things. So it's great to find that bit of news about what's happening at places like universities.
Yeah. And it's groundbreaking. What they're doing is groundbreaking stuff that'll be used across your world, probably.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's for the benefit of humankind is the thing. So a lot of things have got a particular aim, but this is a range of things now that are coming through for diagnostics, which, again, I think anybody's been through the sort of medical world, you can spend an awful lot of time looking for answers. So quick, easy diagnostics that confirm things for you and for your doctor so that you can get treatment have got to be a great move forward.
Yeah, I mean, the battle is still raging in the press, isn't it, about prostate cancer screening. I read about all the time there's big, fors and against doing that because you don't want to unnecessarily worry and treat people when actually it might not be a problem.
No, well, you always get sort of mixed stories of people who've had it and sort of sold you through it and don't realise a lot of the problems. And then you get people who don't realise they've got it and it goes badly wrong. So it's that kind of thing. And say, to be able to identify things quickly and accurately it is a great sort of thing. And I think since we've looked at the human genome, we've talked about a lot of times, there are things that are moving there, but also actually modifying the genome to stop passing on bad things in our genes. So there's a lot of things where particular diseases can be helped to control. So I know there's work underway on Parkinson's disease, which I've seen sort of firsthand from family members, and it can be really sort of a debilitating disease.
Yeah.
So I think genetically identifying the risk and potentially having a treatment early on is a great move forward. So very good. I guess the other thing that, because it's becoming autumn and things are getting a bit windy, that caught my attention was, two things really in one. And the first one that I noticed was a report about the... there was a worldwide accord coming together to cut down on the emissions from shipping across the world. And it was an agreement that was on the cusp of being put together. Apparently, global shipping contributes about 3% of the move towards global warming. But this was an accord that was a lot of countries around the world had signed up to. A lot of the small sort of island nations were for it. Obviously, they want to reduce global warming. And 3% doesn't sound an awful lot, but over time, it's a significant contribution. And apparently, just before they were all going to get together to ratify this, the American administration stepped forward and launched a torpedo into it, stopped the process. They managed to garner enough support.
Oh, hang on. Live radio. Oh, that's America. That could be that could be President Trump saying, hang on a minute, what are you going to say about me? Eh?
Yeah. Lovely doorbell.
Ding dong, Avon calling. I didn't think they did that anymore, Paul.
Yeah.
Are you getting it? Hello.
Okay, talk about later.
Yeah.
Have you got anything interesting? What's come?
Moon pig.
No, a young lady with something tucked under her arm saying, oh, do you want to talk later? No.
Ah.
Oh, dear.
Brilliant.
Yes.
So anyway, yeah, America intervenes.
Yeah, and garnered support from Saudi Arabia, from Russia, various other large countries, to put an end to what was going to be a global accord to reduce the emissions from shipping. And all sorts of quirks from that. I think in the trade war that China and America are having, they're talking about imposing a docking fee for shipping, so that per ton of the ship's weight with its cargo, they're going to impose a charge at either Chinese ports or American ports. America cited it in falling out with that accord that basically they were worried that this would increase costs for consumers. So it's a great bone to sort of pick upon that it's going to save people's costs and they can garner support, but it's not going to help to reduce the emissions from shipping. So the second part of what I was interested in then was it sort of triggered a bit of a memory for me. And you guys are sailors. I don't know if you've ever come across commercial ships with what appear to be massively tall smokestacks. And if you actually look into that, the thing that's been fitted and retrofitted to ships for a while now is a rotary sail. So it's a tall cylinder with slots, and basically as you move with the wind, it reduces the friction and increases the sort of fuel saving. And it started out quite a while back, I think, as something that was the German researcher who was called Flettner, Flettner. And the Flettner sail was turn of the last century, one of those things that was proposed to be a potential means of propulsion for shipping. And the retrofit has been towards making it more economical. So the Flettner sail can be a direct drive towards a small propeller for forward propulsion. It can be electrically stored as power. So the wind can be transformed into power stored to drive that propeller when wind conditions aren't so good. But it started out, I think, with one ship, and really the Flettner sail system, or the rotor ship as it became, started out with the first ship that he produced, and this effect for the propulsion is called the Magnus effect. So, partly powered by a propeller, but largely powered by these vertical rotors, Anton Flettner was the first to build a ship that attempted to use this form of propulsion, and he—excuse me, I'm losing my voice now.
Oh dear, talking too much, Paul.
Yeah, but the Flettner effect is caused by the spinning body in a moving airstream, or a moving body which is spinning, such as a ball, which pulls the air around one side of the object. That's using the friction of the skin to create the skin of the device, to create a difference in air pressure from one side to the other. So a little bit like an aircraft uses it for lift, this can be vectored to be forward propulsion on a ship. So the Flettner rotor was put onto a ship, and they pioneered it with a ship called Buckau, B-U-C-K-A-U, and they constructed that in October of 1924, and it was a refitted schooner that carried two cylinders that were 15 metres or 50 feet high and 3 metres across. So those huge areas, but concentrated rather than spread out like the old sail systems were. And they had an electric propulsion system which was only 50 horsepower for this ship. They sailed it from Danzig to Scotland across the North Sea in 1925. And one of the things, again, if you're used to sailing, is that the ship could tack up to 20 to 30 degrees sailing into the wind. So it meant the rotors didn't give massive problems in stormy weather. So eventually that ship was renamed Baden-Baden, and it was sailed to New York via South America, arriving in New York Harbour on the 9th of May 1926. So some of the naysayers on that time said that the ship had proved inefficient on the voyages, and that the power consumed spinning the 15 metre tall drums was disproportionate to the propulsive effect when you compare it to conventional propellers. So they weren't bothered about the cost of fuel, which was getting cheaper at that time. But if you look at the flip side of that, it was put into service carrying bulk cargo across the North Atlantic and through the Baltic. And when it sailed to New York, which was a 6,200 nautical mile voyage across the Atlantic, it used only 12 tons of fuel oil compared with 45 tons
wow.
for a motor ship of the same size without the rotors. So the second sort of assessment, the more positive one, seemed more accurate. And it was built by a shipyard in Bremen, and it went on to perform reliably as a normal freighter in the Mediterranean between 1926 and 1929. And he was starting to secure more orders for the style of ship, but marine diesel oil and the related engine technology had become steadily and readily more cheap. So fuel prices meant that the savings achieved by the rotor were too small for the big shipping companies to consider because of the payback period being so long. But it's been revived in the 80s. Some modern vessels were fitted out, There was a catamaran with a rotary sail on the Kiel Week, on the Kiel Canal in 2007. And Enercon, a company, have launched a hybrid rotor ship, the E-Ship, on the 2nd of August 2008. And from 2010, it's been used to transport the ship's turbine products and other equipment. So this is large sort of freight. And the stuff's been moved forward. So Airbus, believe it or not, now has a small fleet of these augmented vessels that it uses to ship the aircraft parts across to the USA for their factory in the US that builds Airbus. So sort of an old bit of tech that's found a reinvigoration in modern times, and it's really sort of contributing towards cutting those sort of additional gases that are developing the CO2. So it's, I think, the Airbus commissioned six ships that should be into service now, 2026, to carry this trade of aircraft parts. So it's an intriguing sort of development, and it's one of those things that kind of was looking for its time in history, a bit like lasers when they first arrived, were a fantastic thing for concentrated light beams, but we weren't quite sure how we were going to use them.
Oh, look at us now. Exactly. Yeah. I know.
And things like graphene, which again was one of those novelties from science, which is now steadily finding more and more uses and applications. And a lot of developments are coming from sort of basic physics principles that are applied or reapplied in ways that weren't effective, weren't cost-effective, or weren't recognized sufficiently when they were first identified.
Amazing.
So that's the rotor ship, and kind of an interesting bit of history, but is actually coming back into our modern world.
Amazing. You've got about a minute left as a film shower in, Paul.
Yeah.
So you've chosen a track, and I'm just wondering what the connection is.
Well, I was just thinking, what a lovely day this
morning. So it's nothing to do with your story. I'm thinking, how's he going to build this into his... into
Polaris.
Polaris.
Well, I think if, you, if you're a person of a certain age like me, it's a great track.
I agree.
Great
we
band.
Play some great tracks. But just going very quickly, talking about things, we ordered a PA from a company in York. It came... It was made in the USA. It was... housed at Sweden in a factory or whatever. It came and shipped via Denmark, Germany, London, then to Sheffield.
Yes.
Amazing.
And we all do it from York.
I know. That's modern life. I wonder how many taxes and tariffs went on that, eh? Indeed.
Yeah.
Brilliant speaking to you, Paul. We shall speak to you Monday.
Thank you.
Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3.
I shall look forward to
bye-bye,
it.
Bye-bye, Paul. Bye-bye. Bye.
Cheers. Bye, guys. Bye.
Over bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of green, under dreaming spires, to Ichiku Park, that's where I've been.
What did you do there?
I got high.
What did you feel there?
Well, I cried.
But why the tears there?
Tell you why, it's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind. Get up, feed the ducks with a bun. They all come out to groove about. Be nice and have fun and listen.
I tell you what I'll do.
What will you
do? I'd like to go there now with you. You can miss out school.
Won't that be cool?
Why go to learn the words of who?
What will we do there?
We'll get high.
What will we touch there?
We'll touch the sky.
But why the tea is there?
I'll tell you why.
It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful. It's all too beautiful.
I feel inclined to blow my mind. Get hung up, feed the ducks with a bun. They all come out to groove about the mice and her father in the sun.
It's all too beautiful.